Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
We'll be bringing you some of the best of what's happening in academia, taking it outside of the ivory towers, connecting it to what's buzzing in popular culture, and give you our take.
Taking the undisciplined approach of Africana studies outside of the classroom, into the community, and onto the airwaves, we invite you to share in research, ideas, movements of scholars and students, and members of Africa and the diaspora. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get undisciplined! Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. We're so happy that you've joined us for another episode. We're happy to get into this episode today because we have an amazing guest who has joined us. Part of the reason why I'm also happy is because it goes so well with what you do, also Karee Nisia. Our guest focus and what you do aligns so well.
What do I do these days? You'll have to remind me because I have been swamped with so many responsibilities.
You out here being a Black woman doing the most?
The most. And not the literally.
Doing the most. But, we're excited because today we get to talk to Dr. Candace Cunningham.
Yes.
Who is an assistant professor in the history department here at the University of Arkansas, and who specializes in African American history, women and gender studies, and public history. Her research is focused on 20th century African American experience with a special emphasis on the civil rights movement, education, gender, and the South. She's published numerous articles. I love the title of this one. Hell is popping here in South Carolina. Orangeburg County, Black teachers and their community in the immediate post-Brown era. And that was published in the History of Education Quarterly. She recently, some time ago, collaborated with the Boca Raton Museum of Art to conduct oral histories and write an essay that will accompany a photography exhibit on Pearl City, which is Boca Raton's oldest neighborhood and its only historically Black community. She's working on her manuscript on Black teacher activists, which we're excited to talk about today, and the special role that they played in the civil rights movement. So Candace, we'd like to welcome you to the Undisciplined podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Wonderful.
We're glad you're here too, for sure. you have a extensive wheelhouse there. Before we jump into my passion, teacher activism, and this idea of social justice in the classroom, what is public history?
Oh, great question. So I always like to start by explaining what it's not. So unlike, African-American history or women's history, public history is not the history of the public. I think of it more so as a methodology. So it's a way of teaching history beyond the classroom. And so a lot of people who do public history go into things like museums, archives, national parks and state parks. So it's trying to make history more accessible to the public. And it interweaves with other disciplines like the digital humanities and, as I mentioned before, museums.
So the places where the public is interacting with history, whether we know it or not.
This is a really complicated concept and introduce it to a non-academic audience.
Wonderful. Because this is an interesting time to be doing public history, given that everybody be thinking they're a historian.
What are the qualifications to be a historian?
No, this is a serious topic. I don't know. Maybe it's coming from a place of saltiness. Because everybody feel like because they can read, they're a historian. And, and it seems like a lot, there's a lot of realization about the significance of history. And instead of consulting with the experts like yourself, people are like, yeah, I watch a YouTube video. I did this or that, you know? Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we have this podcast, is to get out what people like yourself are doing, to get it out into the public domain so folks can get access to this level of expertise. But what do you think about all this kind of stuff now, where folks are just thinking,
Well, I mean, people have always thought that, right? People have never, I think there are many people who have never thought of history as an academically rigorous field of research. And that's largely, ironically, because they're not historically trained. And so they don't always understand what historians do. I do like, I have a funny story about this. Like, years ago, I had a student who sort of like, was clearly unhappy with their grade, right? And so went on and on about how much time they spent online researching about World War II, right? And I was like, well, I'm so happy that you're interested in this topic. I've spent hours in archives. And so, you know, I think one of the things that differentiates a historian, an academically trained historian, is their ability to be able to use primary resources. Oftentimes, we are creating primary resources, right? We're doing oral histories with individuals. And so we're interested not only in what other historians have said about a topic, but what we can say about the topic that's original. And
What history makers are have to say too.
And how are we in discussion with what previous historians have said about this topic, or for that matter, what they have not said about that topic, oftentimes how they've left something out of the master narrative, which I think is what many of us are interested in doing, is especially, I think, like in African-American history, we're interested oftentimes in sort of correcting the narrative.
Right. I think that's very interesting. Like, I wonder, how is oral history contributing to African-Americans countering the dominant narrative? And what is oral history?
Oh, that's a very good question. So oral history is oftentimes done as an interview, and you'll sit down with the individual, sometimes more than one individual, and you're basically getting their life story. Now, that can look different. Oftentimes when I've interviewed people, I'm interested in a very particular part of their life story. And so you're creating a primary document, right? You're creating this document that can then go into an archive and be used by future historians. And in fact, many oral history collections are explicitly created by archives and archivists who are interested in creating resources for people, for future researchers to be able to use. And so there are a couple of ways that this can correct the narrative. The first is, oftentimes our history, African-American history, is not as present in these archival collections as they should be. So it's a way of creating these documents to be available to people. And then I think the other way that it can correct the narrative is that sometimes the documentation that is available is very one-sided, and it's only telling one part of the story. Oftentimes it's the part of the people who have the ability to record their stories, right? Or the people whose stories are recorded in newspapers. So that may not include people who are working class. It may not include people who are members of minority groups. It may not include people who are illiterate and unable to actually leave a story behind in the same way that someone else would. And so oral histories can be a very, I think, powerful tool for researchers.
And it's important to also think about, I think, one, that this is a big part of our heritage as Black people, that this is coming from, you know, West Africa, you know, with griots, right, who were members of a class of storytellers and musicians and poets, their gifts as a teaching methodology, right? To kind of keep stories. And I think in Western culture, the privileging of certain kinds of archival forms, right? Whether it's documentation, dense, wordy documentation, you know, would leave other forms of histories out, whether it's African-American history or Native American history. So that's a part of what we do as historians to kind of, you know, look, you know, I think back to Sam Weinberg's article, and I think it became a book, Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts. Like, you know, I was saying earlier, people tend to think of history as like, I can read, so I could do that, right? But they don't consider those questions of power, those questions of sources, the how we get to certain, you know, how we reach to certain consensus and whose story is included in that. And so I think you're doing an amazing job in that regard. But let's talk about what made you interested in becoming a historian. I always love to hear the historian origin story.
I remember like during the pandemic, I kind of like made this group of friends on Twitter, and we were doing like these online discussions on Zoom, right? And people were sharing these like incredible stories they had about these great history teachers they had like in high school or middle school. And my experience was the opposite, right? And so I was like, well, I did not have great history teachers and they couldn't answer the questions that I had. You know, I could see that the narrative that I was being told was incomplete and wrong. It didn't make any sense to me, right? So on the one hand, I was being told that emancipation happens. Well, first of all, I was being told that it happened with the Emancipation Proclamation, which was incorrect, but then the end of the Civil War, right? And then I was told that Black people had complete freedoms, but then also that there was this civil rights movement 100 years later. And that didn't make any sense. Why is there a Voting Rights Act if Black people got, Black men got the right to vote during Reconstruction? So like there were just like obvious problems with the narrative. And so I remember the time I was living actually with my dad in Jackson, Tennessee, which is a small town, but a small town with an HBCU, Lane College. and college libraries are different now. Like a lot of college libraries, you have to like have an ID to go in. Back then, like you could just like walk into basically any college library and no one looked twice. And you could read books whenever you wanted to. And so I started doing research, in Lane's library because I was not getting the answers that I wanted from my teachers. And so when I went to college, I decided to major in history. And it took me a while to decide to go to graduate school. That was a big...
Did you want to be a lawyer?
No, I never wanted to be a lawyer.
Oh, wow.
Historians wanted to be initially, and they got...
I don't know if it's... I know it's something that the parentals... tend to suggest, where history is the foundation of law school, right? You're doing that investigative, analytical work and that storytelling work that lawyers use. And so it's often one of those big majors that feed into law school. So you find a lot of history majors who become lawyers. Yeah. So
great lawyers. So I do have a funny story about this, and it actually intersects with my research. Mm-hmm. So I come from a family of public school teachers. Mm-hmm. So when I went to college, everyone, especially my mom and my aunts, were like, you should get your teaching license.
Oh.
License. And I was like, I do not want to work with kids. I love kids, but I don't want to work with them every day.
Oh my God.
All right, I love them. And I especially knew I didn't want to work with parents. That's what I really knew. So
the helicopters.
I'm like, I think I could deal with kids, but maybe not the parents, actually. So I did not get my teaching license. Okay, so here's the funny part, though. This is like, this is the kids, your mom is always right part of the story. So I get my PhD in history. It's history of education, though, which means that there is another line of jobs I could have applied to, which is in College of Ed, right? Lots of College of Eds have history of education professors.
Wait, okay, back up. Let's spin the block. Uh-huh. You said you have a history of education.
So I do history of education.
Most right, yes, that's what you do in your research.
Colleges of education.
Right, right, right.
So I mentioned all this, kids, right? Your mom is always right. Because if I'd gotten my teaching license,
Your market would
would
have
have
been bigger.
qualified for all of those jobs.
Oh, wow. With less money spent and less hairs falling out of your head for Armenia.
It would have been like a whole other lot of jobs I could have applied to. So that's a lot of folks. Your mom's always right.
Thank you, moms.
So how
That's
you get to you finish the you get into history and you do the PhD, right? What how did you get to this? Tell us about your research and how you got to it.
Sure. So my research is like many people, it's not what I originally thought I was going to do when I went to graduate school. I was going to study SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was very interested in the 1960s. I went to undergrad in Nashville, Tennessee. So I was obsessed with people like Diane
Snick
Nash and
Central.
John Lewis. Yes. So I thought that's what I was going to research. And I was in the archives one summer in South Carolina, at the South Carolina archive on University of South Carolina's campus. And I was looking through the NAACP's annual programs. And so in these programs, it would have like this short history about the South Carolina NAACP. And these programs kept mentioning these cases, these legal cases concerning teachers. And it was just not something I'd really seen before in the narrative. There were certainly people who studied teachers, but it tended to focus on the Reconstruction era. And so the South Carolina NAACP seemed to be saying that this was a really central part of their work in the civil rights movement. And so that's kind of how it started. So I started with looking at one of these cases. And it just sort of grew from there into a course paper and then into an MA thesis and into a dissertation and now into my book manuscript.
How do you feel like, because okay, so I wanted to study education law to, represent teachers, parents, students. As you continue to study the role, like education policy, the history of education, are you finding any reproduction of the same phenomena, same things that were happening then in the NAACP in South Carolina today?
Oh, of course not. I'm just kidding.
And if so, what?
Okay, so let me just outline the things that Black teachers were fighting for. Number one, they were fighting for more educational opportunities. Number two, they were fighting for more teachers. Number three, they were fighting for equal pay. They were fighting for better facilities. And then they were fighting for school desegregation. I think if you think about recent education movements, those are all the very same things that teachers more broadly, really across racial lines, are fighting for. They want more teachers, they want more education, they want better facilities, they want more opportunities for their students.
I read this book. It was Black Teachers on Teaching, and the author separated the book into three parts: the elders, the veterans, and the novices. And the elders were those who experienced teaching and schooling during segregation. The it was the elders. Dang, what did I say?
Veterans, novices.
Yes, the elders, the veterans, the novices. So, and then the veterans were looking at their experience of transitioning from segregated schooling to integrated schooling, and the novices just experiencing integrated schooling. And so, one of some of the most interesting thing I found related to those topics that you were just talking about was, after Brown versus Board of Education, these Black schools were essentially dissolved. Kids were being bused out or going to different schools way outside of their neighborhood. Teachers that were teaching in high school and middle schools then became automatically elementary teachers. And then, principals were then made secretaries, and then the lot of everybody else who couldn't fill those capacities in elementary schools lost their jobs. So when we talk about integration in Brown versus Board of Education, we never really talk about the impact that it had on Black teaching and Black mm-hmm. teachers.
Facts.
Mm-hmm. And Black students.
And Black, yes, and Black students, right.
Yeah. So that is one of the issues I address in my research is what happens after Brown v. Board. And I think it's always important to put integration in quotes.
Right.
Ever happened, right? But so one of the ways that this is happening is also in the teachers' associations. So teachers' associations were also segregated. And one of the things you find with Black teachers' associations is that, especially in states that don't have a teachers' union, they are oftentimes operating as teachers' unions, and they are operating in conjunction very explicitly with the NAACP. Like, they are donating money for these lawsuits to the NAACP. They raise money explicitly for these cases. And so after Brown v. Board, some of these teachers' associations refused to desegregate. Mm-hmm. And it's eventually the National Education Association says, listen, they call out these states and they say, either you desegregate or we are only going to officially recognize the Black Teachers Associations. Hmm. And so they start desegregating. And what happens is that these highly skilled, highly trained, very experienced Black leaders in this teachers associations are unable to retain their leadership positions. So the president becomes the vice president, right? The secretary becomes like the second secretary. And so it's this same system is sort of replicated in the teachers association. And they really feel that they lose this body that had been representing them and understood the explicit issues that they face as Black teachers. And then I also have like an anecdotal story about, this didn't make it to the book, but there was this teacher that I spoke to about her experience. She'd been a French teacher and she really loved it. Like, she would take her students to Paris once a year. And after desegregation, the school tried to force her to become an English teacher, right? And so there's this sort of implicit understanding that surely a Black person can't teach French, right? Uh-huh. Or understand French. Uh-huh. She had to really fight to keep her position. She was able to keep it, but she had to really fight to keep her position. And I like to speak about her because the other piece of her story is she was not an explicit activist, but she knew activists. And she knew this one teacher named Gloria Rackley who got fired for her activism. And so Rackley's students go on strike from school and they're protesting outside the school. And this teacher had this issue. She wasn't sure what to do because she'd always been taught you don't cross picket lines. Mm-hmm. How are you going to work when your schools are picketing outside, your students are picketing outside? And so she sort of makes this bargain with herself, you know, she sort of goes into the back door. And I could tell from speaking to her that she still felt kind of guilty about this decision. But the thing is, she kept her job. And there are like now generations of Black and white and Hispanic students who had this Black French teacher who took them to Paris every year, right? And so there are also all these different ways in which people are sort of engaging with mm-hmm. activism and bringing it into the classroom. That was a long-winded response, but there you go.
It's good though, especially your anecdote about, you know, the, you know, demotion or deprofessionalization of Black teachers. Like, when I was actually thinking about becoming a teacher, I first was thinking about going through Teach for America. And I made this lesson for it to teach 12th grade economics. And I get in there and I teach it and I put fire on that lesson, right? So I finally get my job or my job offer. And they said that they felt that I was fit to teach kindergarten.
Wow.
What about this senior economics lesson made you think that I was capable of teaching kindergarten? I'm 5'10". I scare little kids. Okay. Like, So this idea that, you know, Black teachers belong in elementary, but not at the advanced level of schooling is something that I believe is still happening in different forms and mechanisms right now. And as far as teacher activism, so we've been talking about that in my class with my pre-service teachers and asking them, do they believe that the social studies classroom is a place for teacher activism? And some of them believe that when you're thinking about teacher activism, that it means that you're in the classroom shouting your political beliefs and you're inviting students to rallies with you. And I feel, and you tell me what you think and what you found in terms of teacher activism, in the social studies classroom, teacher activism requires the radical act of love. It requires loving and affirming your students so much that you understand the navigational capital as well as the navigational limitations that they have in American society, and that you prepare lessons that allow them to learn and acquire new information to better navigate society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly why African Americans were fighting for more Black teachers. Mm. They believed that Black teachers were learning, you know, Black teachers who were attending HBCUs, right? That they were learning the necessary skills to prepare their students for life in a segregated world. And that, you know, it obviously went beyond just kind of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And in fact, one of my teachers, one of the teachers at our research, in her lawsuit, right, in her petition, she mentions her students. Right? She says, you know, this is what I'm teaching in the classroom, and I have to live this out. And so I think kind of the space between life outside the classroom and life right. in the classroom for these teachers could sometimes merge.
Yeah, it has
maybe to. In ways that's not happening as much today.
Yeah, like your French teacher. You know, she had to realize that she was offering and opening the world to her students in a way that if she wasn't there, they possibly wouldn't get that opportunity otherwise.
Yeah.
And that role of teacher activism is, I think, like you said, about bridging that space between the world and the school and giving students the socio-political consciousness about how not just this system. I feel like if we're teaching American history, US history, it's a case study for understanding how the world works. It's not understanding just US history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very clear when you read some of these oral histories that have been done with activists, they mention the classroom. So many of them mention what they learned in high school. So it's actually kind of encouraging because it feels like sometimes your students are listening.
For sure.
Some of them are, and they really are learning important civics lessons.
But so 92% of my teachers are non-Black students. Mm-hmm. And their question is, can I, as a non-Black, non-Latino, non-LGBTQ plus person, can I educate my students and have that level of activism with them when I don't represent their social identity? What are you finding with your teachers? How are they, having to deal today with that issue of cross-cultural connection and communication in the classroom as it relates to activism?
Yeah, I mean, so certainly the teachers in my research they're all Black, they're teaching Black students in Black schools. So it's a very specific situation. I do, in my epilogue, talk about current issues facing teachers. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of things. One, you know, obviously these people are overwhelmingly women. and two, we do find that in many schools, the people who are teaching underprivileged children, which does not always equate with specifically with Black, but the people who are overwhelmingly teaching these underprivileged children do seem to still be Black women. Mm. So that's kind of an interesting part of the conversation to think about as well, in how is this happening and why is this happening? I think that teachers today also need to think about these issues about class, right? And because there's also evidence that a teacher who can understand what it means to be working class, and then to kind of, they understand social mobility in a way that someone who's always been middle class maybe wouldn't understand it. In some ways, I think, you know, the story today is, it seems more complicated to me, more, even more nuanced. And so the answers also seem harder to find.
Yeah.
I don't know what you all think about.
You're telling a story that most probably people feel like they're familiar with, right? Mm-hmm. Like I often joke when students come into my class, they often like to take African-American studies or African-American history. They're like, okay, just Martin Luther King had a dream. Okay, good. Yes, we've got it. Good, done. But your work is exposing all of the nuances and complexities of the civil rights stories and mm-hmm. who we think the heroes are of the stories. And you know, these people out here don't be trying to credit Black women with nothing.
Not a thing.
I am mad salty about this.
They take our stuff with a heart.
It should be.
People like, that was a contribution.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've had to suffer. So you're telling this story. Tell us how the stories about teachers, a lot of them who are African-American women, kind of destabilize the story that we think we know about the civil rights movement.
Yeah, so I think there are a few things. I mean, one is there is, and I would say this narrative has largely been overturned, but there is still a narrative that people believe, which is that teachers weren't activists and that they were so invested in preserving their jobs that they were unwilling to sort of put those jobs on the line. So I think first, it undermines that notion. Then I think it also adds some nuance to, you know, I definitely don't try to paint segregation as a rosy picture, but I do try to make really clear about the ways in which segregation pushed people, including teachers, to be very invested in their community, right? Because they worked in that community, but they also lived in that community. And so I think it's sort of under one of the things that I've tried to push back against is this notion that like Brown v. Board was inevitable, mm-hmm. right? That was even always a goal. It wasn't always a goal for Black people. Right. In fact, Black people had to be convinced that it was a good idea, and some of them never were. Mm-hmm. So I think it gives us a different idea about how to look at the civil rights movement. And I like to think of it as looking at the civil rights movement like from the ground up, and it gives a different perspective. And I think also looking at teachers are sort of interesting, particularly during this era, because they're, you know, on the one hand, these are educated people, they're respectable members of society. They're middle class. I say middle class, despite the fact that their incomes don't necessarily reflect that.
Middle class Black folks.
yeah. They're middle class Black folk. But on the other hand, they're also this group that's consistently targeted, like explicitly targeted by state legislators. And so it's interesting, right? Because on the one hand, they're sort of disempowered, but on the other hand, I think it also shows us that everyone knew, including segregationists, that education was powerful, and that getting Black children an education was powerful, and that the symbol of an educated middle-class Black woman or man was a powerful image, and that all of these things, right, proving that Black children were teachable, this was diametrically opposed to white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And everyone knew it, right? Via their actions and their words, white supremacists proved that they knew what this was, right? And what it could potentially do to the power structure. And so I think it helps us look at education a bit differently and understanding how people of the time or thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Because you have Black schools with Black teachers and Black students in Black communities, right? And we were given the hand-me-down textbooks that were torn apart. Our school facilities were also full of hand-me-down furniture. Things were not working, but education was succeeding still. Mm-hmm. You know, the persistence of to pursue knowledge was still deeply seated within our connection to education. And Brown versus Board really upset that and flipped it on its head, and then, splintered us into all these different communities of schools and integrated our schools where we were then unwelcome, where then we didn't have teachers that were trained to teach us.
Mm-hmm.
Another anecdote from the book Black Teachers on Teaching was that they were in a PD session. And they did a 2-day session just teaching white teachers how to interact with Black students in mm-hmm. very deficit ways, of course. And then at one point, a Black male teacher stands up and says, okay, well, you've been teaching the white teachers how to teach the Black students this whole time, but you haven't told me if I go and visit a student's home, do I go to the back door, the front door, or the side door?
Mm.
Yeah. And so, you know, and that's why I'm wondering, even with these Black teachers, you know, and me myself as a black professor and teacher, you know, how do I, you know, teach white teachers, white mm-hmm. Latino teachers, you know, to be able to reach and speak and provide that same navigational capital in their heart, have that in their heart to do for our Black students or for our Latino students or any underrepresented population?
That's still the question, girl.
Still the
you
question.
Can answer, let us know.
Look, I'm working on it every day.
Yeah, so it's quite fascinating, you know, that so much of the civil rights movement takes place in schools, and then to not include the teachers as major actors, as a major constituent of this movement, and to understand all the roles that African-American women played, from one of my favorites, Fannie Lou Hamer, mm-hmm. you know, Ella Baker, all of those folks played in the civil rights movement. But understand all the strategery, child, that's like my favorite. Oh my God, like the strategery. Like yeah. You think you're finna play us?
Yeah. And it makes us realize that we have to be very critical of the policies that are being passed today. Brown versus Board of Education, we're able to look back now with a more critical set of eyes, right? And when I say critical, I just mean that we're asking questions, that we're looking at the impact that the artifact, which is the policy, has on people. And so we have to be really careful when policies are passed and they seem very objective and neutral and non-harming to anybody. Mm-hmm. But we have to really be activists as citizens, as teachers, as parents, as students. It takes all of us as a community to come to this table and have the conversation and be a part of the policymaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, teachers were very active in developing the NAACP strategy. That's the other piece. You know, we talk about mm-hmm. education, right? It was teachers who were initially saying, you know, I want to fight for equal pay. You know, I want to fight for more teachers. I want to fight for better facilities. They were really pushing the NAACP strategy. And they were and these teachers associations were oftentimes the one sort of choosing which person would be a best litigant, right? Like, oh, well, this person.
Right. Yeah.
He's about to go off. He's literally about to go off to war. He's not going to be a good litigant. You know, this person. Megan say this about her. Well, this person, she's ideal. She's perfect. And so they were very active in making those decisions as well. But we've kind of really honored the lawyers, right? The Thurgood Marshalls,
yes,
and attorneys, and they played an essential role. But there was all this other work being done. I wouldn't even say behind the scenes. We just haven't really seen it.
No. They're not behind the scenes at all. They're very much in the middle, you know, as you said, strategizing about this is a good case. I think this can take down this, you know, separate but equal claim. This case can move forward. They were the ones identifying and contacting the NAACP and willing to put their children in their home and all of this kind of stuff on the line, and to know the ins and outs of what's going on in the schools and all of this kind of stuff. stuff. So, that's why we say African Americans are the custodians of American democracy. Mm-hmm. Thank mm-hmm. you very much. Right. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to know how policy is, ask the people who have to feel it. Right. Who have to live with it, who have to contend with the policy. Or right. Almost. According to my boyfriend, James Baldwin. It's like I have all these boyfriends, but it's Frederick Douglass, then James Baldwin.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Brotherhood going here. I see you.
But Candace, here's a question I want to ask you. You know, back in like, was it the 90s that they had all these films about the white teachers going to, well, there was this onslaught of films about Black schools, right?
Gangster's Paradise, anyone?
Yeah. Very East Side High. But all of these films, many of them were featured, you know, Sister Act, one of my favorites. But there was also this genre film of white teachers going to the hood to teach in the schools, and, you know, having this awakening come to Jesus moment, Damascus Road, right? And do you watch these films? Are these films or media a part of your, or do you extend your critique or your understanding of how education or African-American education is kind of portrayed to the public, to this kind of a digital media? And which one's your favorite to kind of like watch?
Well, I would say like I probably have like less tolerance than I would have back in the 90s when I was two. I do
love Whoopi and Sister Act. It's just, yeah, masterpiece theater.
But I don't know, I haven't really thought as much about the films. Like, I've never even seen that film Blindside, because by the time that came out, I knew I didn't really have any patience for the white savior complex. Mm-hmm. So I would say, like, I haven't even watched those films since I've become like a more critical person. But if I think about them, and you mentioned like their portrayal of Black education and Black students, I think, mm-hmm. and also like particularly with the films that portray, you know, a cute Michelle Pfeiffer going into a Black classroom and being the one that makes a difference. Like, also the portrayal, therefore, of Black teachers, right? Of,
right.
Right. Not being able to handle these students. I mean, I think that's not only not historically accurate, I don't even think that's accurate in the present day. I think when you look at people who are able to get a handle on these classrooms, they're oftentimes people who are sort of mm-hmm. community members.
Yeah, they tend to give us the hardest classes, what they call, quote unquote, the most difficult students, and they'll put them all in the same class with the Black teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, because we're the mules.
Yeah, and then look shocked when she figures it out. How did you do that? It's amazing.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I think Luigi is. Yeah. So that is something that's kind of interesting to think about, but I'm not sure it's something I've given much thought.
Yeah, I would love to see something about you know, even The Wire. Like, have you guys seen The Wire? Because I'm gonna judge you if you say no.
I haven't seen it. I haven't had anything related to cable. And
we have been reading days. And writing only.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Thanks for privileging books. But yeah, The Wire, I think Wire season 2 focuses, you know, Wire is about drugs and urban, you know, city. And I think season 1 maybe looks at, you know, the criminal networks, but season 2 goes in, I guess, to the education system to, I guess, figure out how people fall into that system, right? Get onto the corners, get into, you know, dealing drugs and all of that kind of stuff. And so Is it season two or is it season four? Not quite sure, but one of my, of course, one of my favorite shows. So yeah, I imagine a lot of people get their view of African-American education and understand of who African-Americans are through film, right? Sure. So yeah. It's an area that is ripe for critique that, you know, should be brought to heel.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. I have my students in my classroom management class. We look at these concepts of classroom management through film. And so even
sweet.
Yeah. So like, I'm like, man, I need these, they're not in internship at the moment and I need them to see classrooms and I need to see them how students are
tell us about which films you show.
Okay. one particularly I show Lean on Me, which I'm always very ambivalent about showing Lean on Me because one, the language, but also the portrayal of how the students are portrayed as animals. And all of a sudden when the school becomes Black, let me just give you the plot. So the school starts off as a mixed race, mostly white school, but then it's sold to the district for renovation. And then the district abandons the school and shuffles all the Black students in the neighborhood to that school. And then all of a sudden it's drug ridden, crime ridden, and all the students are out of control and all the teachers have abandoned their responsibility and everybody has to. And a Black principal comes in and turns the
Is that the Morgan?
Yes.
Your boy.
Father Morgan. he comes and turns the school around, and but it's just we study it from this place of okay, how are the students being portrayed here? How are the administrators being portrayed here? Do we feel like this is a sound plan or doctrine for classroom management? This harsh, you know, this harsh punitive kick students out of schools, or should we resort more to like restorative justice, and how could restorative justice be applied to this school rather than taking this let's kick them out type of approach? So, you know, like it, I'm very always ambivalent about showing it. If you haven't seen it, watch it and you'll understand mm-hmm. why I'm like, ooh, scratch. Mm-hmm. So let's think.
Do you show Abbott Elementary?
I don't, only because I haven't watched it. And the only reason why I haven't watched Abbott Elementary is because I want to write my own show and I don't want to bite off of them. So, you know, like I'm a little jealous. I'm not going to front. I'm like, oh, you beat me to it. You know, like,
oh my God.
I want to write Karenicia High School.
Wonderful. Did you have another question, Karenicia?
No.
Yeah. But it's those are pretty, you know, good significant perspective, and I'm glad, like, you know, classes like that are being taught at the U of A. Candace, what is your next project that you're thinking about after this project, which is going very well? Mm-hmm.
So there are a couple of things. I'm working on an article about this episode, like in the 1930s, when the Washington, D.C. schools are targeted, and they're targeted by the U.S. legislature. U.S. legislature starts banning books, many of which deal with, ironically, the Black experience. So I'm researching that, and then my next booklet manuscript is going to look at the national strategy for equalizing Black teachers' salaries. And these were a series of lawsuits, primarily across the South and Midwest, that endeavor to equalize salaries between Black and white teachers. And what I found is that this was a really important precursor to Brown v. Board, because they're making this argument for essentially equalization before they make this argument for desegregation. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the activism of Black teachers with these lawsuits, what you find is that the NAACP comes out of this series of lawsuits as what we think of the NAACP. They come out of this with being at the forefront of the legal strategy for civil rights. Right. So they are building themselves on Black teacher salary equalization cases. And so essentially what I anticipate I'll be arguing in this my next book is that Black teachers really made the NAACP's legal strategy.
Mm-hmm.
They were the people who made the organization that made the movement.
Wow, you're finna be in Hollywood with this one. You're finna be Hollywood Candace.
No, and I really like this idea of teacher activism because I think there's a lot of Black folks. One, where are all the Black teachers today? Where are you? We need you. We call you back to the field.
Well, according to our last episode, right, with Mitchell Holiday, who is a PhD student in the College of Education, right, there's a mass exodus of teachers.
Yes.
And teachers are quitting left and right.
Yeah.
Protest after protest, especially here in Arkansas with the LEARNS Act.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Come on through and let me train you. We'll have a good time and you'll be successful while you do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's a huge teacher shortage, right? So it's not just an issue amongst Black folks, right? About mm-hmm. why we are not entering the teaching profession. But even before this exodus, 92% of the teaching workforce were white people. You know, the majority of that being white female. And so where, you know, even going back to that book, Black Teachers on Teachers, the novices said that Black folks didn't want to be teachers because we felt that we didn't get paid enough. I mean, I came out of my undergrad, bachelor's and master's and went into teaching and my life has been just fine. Like I've been making pretty good stable money and making, you know, increases in salary, you know, even as a teacher, you know, like, so I think this idea that teachers don't make enough money is one, a myth that we have to bust, but also by doing, bust it by acknowledging the fact that there is room to make more money. There is room to grow in the profession and to, you know, make more money in other arenas and areas, but getting our foot in the door to make money, but also this idea of activism that you're talking about, like, you know, how working class teachers will better be able to understand and meet the needs of working class students because of their, you know, communication psychologically and culturally. You know, and so so to also bust the myth, bust the myth that you have to be some exceptionally, you know, genius and, mm-hmm. and to be well versed in the complete knowledge of the content that you would be teaching. And that's not the case. Yeah. A lot of times it starts with the heart of the teacher, with the passion of the teacher, with the enthusiasm of the teacher. That's what makes a good teacher, not what you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is interesting because this was the arguments that teachers in Mississippi were making, like sort of in the not the name of it, but the program that sort of predated what we now think of as like pre-K. Mm-hmm. You know, these were not Head necessarily,
Start? Huh? Head Start?
Yes. Right. So they were, some of these teachers were not educated. They were not necessarily what you would think of as an educated teacher today.
What you mean educated in the kinds of institutional sense that we think of today? Because, you know, I think about even in African-American studies, since we've now become bougie, right? We in the university, we in the house, child.
Yeah.
We in the big house. And if you think about what that transition has meant for the folks who did Africana studies before that.
Yeah.
Like, I went after the 60s and Black studies got in the university, all of those people who were not credentialized.
Right.
Got cut off. Word.
Credentials. Yeah.
Credentialized. Right. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So they got kicked out because they were actually the activists. They yeah. were the activist teachers,
right?
You know what I mean? And the system didn't want them. Mm-hmm. And so they used the credentials as a part of the weeding out process.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got to give me some for that.
It's also true for women's studies programs. Like all of these studies programs, like women's studies programs, Latin American studies programs, like most
Asian
of these
studies
out of movements.
Yes.
Right. And they get adopted or maybe co-opted.
Co-opted is a very, it's fighting words.
And so like, I mean, a movement, you know, that I feel like
well, Black students want them, right? But students want these classes, and sometimes it's the students who are demanding these programs. But then in the process of getting them into universities, yeah, the people who were the activists get pushed out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What were you saying, Karenicia?
I was saying that, like, you know, I feel like this idea of grow your own programs where communities start teaching academies at high schools and community colleges so that they can draw folks from the community into teacher education so that they will then teach in their local communities, mm-hmm. I think is one form of place-based activism that we can engage in. Is how do we bring, how do we sponsor grow your own programs in a way that nurtures who we're growing to nurture other folks and not just growing folks in the image of the dominant narrative or in the image of reproducing what has already been educational malpractice in the school as it relates to Black and Brown and underrepresented populations. So I think that's one inroad for teacher activism that communities of people can participate in is lobbying at your school board meetings through written communication, not just oral communication. Is not enough to just go and speak at the board meetings. You have to be able to provide written communication for the expressing of that need for it to be seen as legitimate. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one way that we can support getting more teachers of color to represent the percentage of population that our country represents in our diversity, that our teachers would also represent that diversity, perhaps through Grow Your Own programs.
Wow.
I love that idea.
Yep. And, you know, as Black people, we've always had to rely on that community, you know, that Ubuntu, you know, I am because we are. Yeah. But that is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, again, we're just so grateful to have had Dr. Cunningham to talk to us about all this stuff today, because, you know, I don't know if I can think about anybody who does not have someone who a teacher inspired them. Mm-hmm. I can think about all my teachers who are in a row talks too much. And I'm like, look at this. Now I'm talking for a living. You know, who inspired me and whatnot. So I'm glad that teachers are getting their shine in your book. And we can't wait for it to drop, child. You know, we're going to hype it up. So let us know when it comes out. And, you know, we are just so proud of you and everything that you're doing. And look forward to celebrate more of your success in the future.
Yes. Thank you.
Tell us one more time the title of the book and where folks will be able to find it when it drops.
So the title of the book is I Hope They Fire Me, Black Teachers in the Fight for Equal Education. And it is under contract with the University of Georgia Press. Should be out early 26.
All right.
Wonderful. We're looking forward to that and looking forward to all the other works that, you know, you will have coming out. So thank you for talking with us today, Dr. Cunningham. Hope to see more of you in the future.
Thank you.
Bye. Wonderful. Bye. Bye. Bye.
See later.
Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined. This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Karenicia Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African American Studies Program and the Undisciplined Podcast on Instagram at @UARK_AAST or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you like today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.